This past year, we said goodbye to a number of remarkable Iowans. This hour, we look back at their lives. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we hear about several notable Iowans who passed this year by speaking to people who knew them well. We'll hear about Willie Glanton, the first African-American woman elected to the Iowa legislature. Harold Hayes, the last surviving member of a band of airborne American medics and nurses who crash-landed in Nazi-occupied Albania in 1943. Also, Jason Oglesby, a heroic Iowan at the center of a Pulitzer Prize-winning photo, and others as well. Recalling some notable Iowans who passed in 2017. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today on River to River, as the year comes to an end, we're remembering a number of remarkable Iowans we said goodbye to in the past year. Not a comprehensive account of all those notable Iowans who have left us in 2017, of course, but a number of people whose lives speak to the outstanding type of individuals, the character we can be proud to call Iowans. Willie Stevenson Glanton was the first black woman elected to the Iowa legislature. She was also a pioneering figure in the state's civil rights movement. Glanton died in July at the age of 95. I spoke with Iowa House member Helen Miller and started by asking her about her relationship with Willie Glanton.
I knew her pretty well. I actually met her in 2000, right after I moved to Iowa. We belong to a national organization called Lynx Incorporated, and I joined the Des Moines chapter, and that's where I met her.
Mm-hmm. And you had a special relationship with her. You are also African-American, right?
Yes, I'm African-American. I'm an attorney. I belong to all the groups that she belonged to, and I serve in the legislature, so yeah.
I understand. She was not a native Iowan, originally from Arkansas.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about her life, what brought her to Iowa, and what we should remember her for?
I think probably what brought her to Iowa was her husband, Luther Glanton, graduated from Drake's Law School, and she did attend law school herself at Robert Terwell's Law School in Washington, D.C., and graduated from there, and after that, that's when she came to Iowa. She was she joined the Iowa Bar, actually in 1953, which was a very long time ago, and she practiced here in the state of Iowa. As a matter of fact, she was the first black female attorney with the Polk County.
Such a list of firsts that she, as a trailblazer, had. First woman, first black person to be elected president of the Iowa chapter of the Federal Bar Association, first woman to be assistant Polk County attorney, first black female legislator, we mentioned that. She received many awards in her lifetime.
And don't forget, she was the first black person to serve on the Des Moines City Council.
Yeah.
She was appointed, but then lost the election.
Give us a sense. You said, you know, going back to the middle of the 20th century, 1953, you mentioned that date. Give us a sense of what it was like to be ascending to these positions as a black woman.
I think it would have been absolutely incredible. In, I believe it was 2014, I threw a party for her, celebrating 50 years, the anniversary of her joining the Iowa House of Representatives. And it was wonderful to have folks like Roxanne Conlon and a number of speakers there to talk about what things were like and what her career was like. It was her personality, her graciousness, her genuineness, her calmness. I've seen her in a situation where any other individual would have been extremely upset, but Willie Stevenson Glanton handled it with grace, and she was generous and kind about what happened.
Even facing what I imagine would be instances of prejudice and discrimination, you mean?
That, as well as about years ago, probably 2003 or 4, I did a resolution honoring the National Bar Association and the Iowa House of Representatives. And there were members from that organization. That's the African American Bar Association that was actually founded in Des Moines, Iowa in 1925. And the group, there were a group of people from the Bar Association, National Bar Association, came to Des Moines, and they came to the State House with the resolution, which was supposed to be read and everything. And there was something going on in the House, and the Speaker, Christopher Rantz, just shut down the session. So all of these people were there, and yet we could not present this resolution. That was a moment when one would have thought that she'd be quite upset, but she wasn't. She just kept the day moving right along. The folks went over to Drake University Law School, did the program, and you would not have thought that anything that traumatic had happened with all these people having come in from different parts of the country for this event.
What made her, do you believe, so passionate about public service and civil rights?
I heard her talk about that a number of times, and to me, I believe it was her family, her upbringing, her sense of duty, her awareness of what was going on and what needed to be done. Everyone, I think, faces issues in their own way, and I think her own way was very, very special. She did it with grace, finesse. She was just the ultimate, consummate lady. And if Willie Glanton was in a room, the way she carried herself, the way she appeared, the way she spoke very gently, very kindly, you could not help but pay attention to her and recognize her as someone who was very, very special, irregardless of her color. We miss her grace. We miss her kindness, her thoughtfulness. She was soft-spoken, and she was direct. She had a great sense of humor, too.
Okay. Remembering Willie Glanton, the first black woman elected to the Iowa legislature, a pioneer in our state's civil rights movements, among many other things. Glanton died in July at the age of 95, and we've been joined by Representative Helen Miller of Fort Dodge. Thank you so much for helping us remember a really great individual and a great Iowan.
Thank you for having me.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In this year-end edition, we're remembering a number of notable Iowans who passed this year. Don Nickerson, the first African-American man to serve as U.S. Attorney in Iowa, died in September. He was 66. Nickerson also served as a Polk County District Court Judge. That was from 2003 to 2011. He graduated from Iowa State University in 1974, degrees in journalism and sociology. He then attended Drake Law School. Joining us now to tell us a little bit more about the work and life of Don Nickerson, Polk County District Judge Odell McGee. Welcome to our program, Judge.
Well, thank you very much.
I understand
you asked me to talk.
We are glad to have you on. I understand you met Don Nickerson in 1974 and actually became friends in law school at Drake.
That is correct. He came from Iowa State, and I came from Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Iowa. And as a freshman at the Drake Law School, we met and became good friends over the years.
Mm-hmm. You've known him for many decades. What stood out for you about his obvious passion for public service? What motivated him at his core?
Well, you know, Don was a dedicated public servant, as you stated, and he spent his entire legal career advocating for the rights of marginalized people. I've always known he was a champion of the small person and did not particularly care for the limelight. He was a man who really championed the causes and the people who were poor, and that's what stood out. He was always advocating or trying to help someone who was downtrodden and not a regular part of the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. I understand even way back in law school when you were both young men, he got top grades, but didn't brag about it, didn't?
No. He was always trying to be understated. He never wanted to have the limelight. He wanted to, you know, let someone else do that. But he just stayed in the back of the room or stay quiet and not say very much about how good he was. He was always on the state, a brilliant man, very, very smart, and had a good understanding of the law and society overall. but he didn't feel that he had to be standing out front to help people. He felt that it was just acceptable for him to be in the back rooms or wherever he can, as long as he was providing a service. And that's what he tried to do in his life.
I see that he was the son of an Episcopal minister. Could you tell, knowing him so many years, the part that faith played in his motivation for public service?
Well, I think that was one of the major factors and why he was so interested in public service. His father was a great bishop of Delaware, and had done all of this work and had moved them around and had been involved in congregation, and of course had seen a lot of poverty, he had seen a lot of pain by people who came to God, and I think that it was a major factor and the reason why he chose to specifically dedicate himself to helping others. So I think that was a major factor in what he ultimately decided to do with his life.
Of course, in his career, he dealt with many, many cases. Are there cases you could point to that you connect Don Nickerson with that are telling in some way about his work and his life?
Well, one case that stands out, and I'm sure some of your listeners probably remember, was the case of State versus Flores. Mr. Flores was charged with the murder of Phyllis Davis. There had been a gangland shooting here in Des Moines, and Ms. Davis was an executive with a bank, and she had been driving through not a great neighborhood of Des Moines, and there had been some gangland violence, and she had ultimately been killed. Well, Mr. Flores was convicted, but come to find out, the prosecuting attorney had kept some information away from Mr. Flores's attorney. And this case was front page back then, Don Nickerson was called upon to rule on whether the fact that this information had been taken from kept from Mr. Flores, if that was sufficient to overturn the case. And there was a tremendous amount of discussion as to whether that case should have been overturned. It was a hard case in the first place because they really didn't have very good witnesses, kind of a circumstantial case. And to retry it, the county attorney was going to be running the risk of potentially losing it. But Nickerson bit the bullet. I mean, his colleagues and a lot of folk across the country felt that there was sufficient evidence over and above this piece of evidence that had been kept away from his attorney to convict him. But Nickerson bit the bullet and said no. If his rights were violated, then he should have a new trial. And that was the kind of person he was. Ms. Flores was just Spanish laborer and particularly involved with gangland. A lot of people would have probably found that there was sufficient evidence to sustain the case over and above this information that his attorney did not receive. But that's the kind of guy he was. He's also he was involved in clemency. He went to just a person who walked into his office one day when he was in private practice. This is the kind of guy he was. This is the guy had got into some trouble, and the senator from the state of Iowa was considered granting him clemency, but he had to have it done in a certain amount of time. Don, working on this man's case, took his own money and went to D.C. To really talk to the senator about granting this man clemency, and was able to get this man clemency based on the fact that, you know, the crime that he had done was when he was young and so on and so forth. But that's the kind of person he was. He intervened on the part of the people that other folk probably would not have taken the time to do so. But he did. He would intervene. And this was typical for him.
Okay.
I mean, I could talk about several other cases like this, but he was always interested in those who were denied certain things in the criminal justice system and try to make it a little bit more fair by granting equal access to justice for everyone.
Well, thank you for helping us understand the importance, the remarkable man that Don Nickerson was. Polk County District Judge Odell McGee, thank you very much. Our condolences for the loss of your friend this year, and it sounds like you will miss him personally as well.
think the legal system is going to miss him. I think our judicial system in Iowa will miss him. You know, it's good to have different types of folks and also different type of folks with different perspectives. And his was a little different, but he was always looking out for those who really needed help. And I appreciate that part.
Okay, Judge McGee, thank you for the conversation.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we're spending the hour remembering several notable Iowans who passed on this year. In January, Indianola native Harold Hayes died at the age of 94. Hayes was the last surviving member of a band of airborne American medics and nurses who crash-landed in Nazi-occupied Albania. This was in 1943. They survived so much. German attacks, blizzards, horrific hardships, also a 600-mile trek to their rescue on the Adriatic coast. Joining us now to tell us more about Harold Hayes and this little-known mission, Kate Lineberry, author of a book that told this dramatic World War II story. It's called The Secret Rescue, an untold story of American nurses and medics behind Nazi lines. Kate, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us to remember Harold Hayes, the last surviving member of this amazing group. And this story didn't get told very much, but take us back, because Harold Hayes, it's important to note here, Kate, that Harold Hayes, I understand, was the one you drew on extensively for your book. His account informed your book. Give us a brief summary of this incredible survival story. And at the time, Hayes was just a 21-year-old. He was one of the medics on board, right?
He was. He had volunteered. He was drafted initially, but had volunteered to be a medic and was stationed in Italy and was working with the Medical Air Evacuation Transport Squadron, helping evacuate patients from different places in Italy, getting them to better equipped hospitals. When this group of Americans, there had been some bad weather in Bari, Italy, and the planes had been unable to get out and get some of the patients out. And so the commander of Harold's unit had sent half of his squadron to Bari, Italy, and they got caught in a storm. Normally, there would only be one or two medics on an individual trip, but he had half his squadron, and he jokingly said later he would never do that again, because it ended up turning into this months-long ordeal. They got caught in a storm during which they were attacked by Nazi planes. They were disoriented over the Adriatic and ended up having to crash land in a place they weren't even sure where they were. Little did they know they had landed in Albania, which was not only part of course, World War II, but also it was undergoing a civil war. So when they were rescued by Albanian partisans, they did not know that they were also in the middle of a civil war with the Vali Komtar. So it was quite an ordeal that they, mm-hmm. they survived months in the winter in Albania.
Mm-hmm. And luckily, even in that first encounter, after the crash-landed plane, they stumbled out of the woods in Albania, not knowing where they were. And a real bit of luck, they encountered an anti-German partisan leader there in Albania. So many aspects we can't cover here about this tale of survival. What were the one or two of the most shocking aspects that you thought this was that made this such an amazing story?
Well, one of the things that drew me to the story originally was the fact that there were so many women involved, and I wondered how that had happened. These women were volunteer nurses who were really, at a time when most people had never been on an airplane, were willing to volunteer to help their fellow American soldiers. And, of course, you know, it was also heroic for Harold to volunteer as well, because this was a time when airplanes were still considered very dangerous. And here they were putting their lives at risk every day trying to help mm-hmm. other people. But I think the fact that the Albanians helped the Americans by hiding them, by giving them the food, the little food that they had, you know, they were taking food from their children to give a little bit to the Americans. It was a very touching story of people really sacrificing to help one another.
Right, and making sacrifices even after the war. It was interesting, and this is also a reason that it's little told, a little known story. Those native Albanians who helped Hayes and the rest of the Americans survive, some were even executed long after the end of World War II, right?
That's true. Enver Hoxha was a communist dictator who took over for 50 years in Albania. And unfortunately, at least one of the partisans who helped them, Stefa Kostov, was executed for helping the Americans. It was a crazy time, and it's part of the reason that the Americans did not discuss this for so long. They originally signed papers saying they wouldn't tell anybody what had happened because they didn't want to jeopardize any other downed airmen who might get help from people to escape as well. But it later became important to help the Albanians who were trapped under communism to not be punished for their role in the rescue.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a sense, talking with Hayes at length about this, the type of person he was, what sort of man he was personally?
Yes, he was an incredible man. I mean, when I contacted him initially, he was 89 years old, and we started corresponding over email and phone, and he was scanning photos for me and, you know, just very technologically savvy. But when I made my research trip over to Albania for part of the book, Harold desperately wanted to come, and his wife and daughter finally convinced him that it was not a great idea for him to travel so far at his age. But he did give me a letter to the Albanian president, which I delivered to the president, thanking the Albanian people for saving them. And that was the kind of man that Harold was. He never considered what he had done as heroic. He was just mainly wanting to give credit to the Albanian people mm-hmm. who helped them so much.
And this all happened when he was 21 years old. He had a lot of life to live after that. Dying in 2017 at the age of 94, a quick race through the rest of his life. He quite accomplished aeronautical engineer, right? He also worked for the Air Force, for NASA.
He did, and he had a brilliant mind. He ended up creating a beautiful life for himself with his wife, had two daughters. It was just a very happy, content person, and it was an absolute honor to get to know him through this whole process.
All right, very good. Thank you for helping us remember Harold Hayes, the last surviving member of a band of airborne American medics and nurses who crash-landed in Nazi-occupied Albania in 1943. We touched really on barely anything, but the intrigue, the drama of this story is all captured in Kate Lineberry's book, The Secret Rescue, An Untold Story of American Nurses and Medics Behind Nazi Lines. Thank you so much, Kate, for helping us remember this remarkable Iowan, Harold Hayes. And on the way out, you working on a new book?
I just published a new one. It's called Be Free or Die, The Amazing Journey of Robert Small's Escape from Slavery to Union Hero.
So you like survival stories.
I do.
All right. Well, look forward to that one. Kate Lineberry, thanks again.
Great. Thank you.
I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces. All day through.
After a short break, we continue remembering some of the remarkable people the community of Iowa lost in 2017. When we come back, we remember a heroic Iowan at the center of a Pulitzer Prize-winning photo. Also a man who didn't learn to read until he was 54 because of undiagnosed dyslexia, and then became an advocate for adults with learning disabilities. Also, we remember former Lieutenant Governor Joy Corning. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're remembering a few notable Iowans who died this past year in 2017. Maybe you remember that dramatic photo from June of 2009. A construction worker dangles from a crane to rescue a woman from the churning waters of the Des Moines River. It's a photo that earned a Pulitzer Prize. The heroic construction worker at the center of that photo, Jason Oglesby, died in April of 2017. I spoke about him and about that incident with Kyle Munson, Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. He wrote about Jason's life in an article after his passing. I began by noting that Kyle Munson's headline named him a complicated hero. And then I asked him to take us back to that rescue in 2009 and how the couple's boat plunged over the Center Street Dam.
Yeah, and this played out right in downtown Des Moines. And so it was this dramatic scene, you know, news crews swarming to the site. And it just so happened this construction crew was nearby as Patty and her husband, you know, tumbled over the dam. And they both could have died that day. Well, her husband did die, but there's this dramatic photo, the one that you've already mentioned, where Jason Oglesby, the construction worker, dangling, you know, from a crane and plucking Patty out of the churning water. And I had a couple of colleagues, photographer colleagues, on the scene that day, shooting from both sides of the riverbank. And then one of those photos is the one that became the iconic image of that moment.
Right, right. And it did get so much press, not only in this country, but outside, didn't it?
Yeah. And so here was this everyday construction worker, just doing his job and in kind of the right place at the right time, who then his image then is flashed around the world all of a sudden, and not something that he would have chosen to have happened to himself, let alone the fact that he always felt bad, the fact that he wasn't able to also save the husband's life.
Right. Her husband, Patty's husband, Alan, drowned in that emergency when that boat went over the Center Street Dam. Your colleague Mark Hansen of the Register, you quote him in your article remembering this. He wrote, "Strangers are talking about Oglesby as if he's Indiana Jones in a life jacket, and rightfully so." So he attained very quickly hero status. Was he comfortable with that title?
No, not at all. I mean, both at the time and then in the wake of his death, it was very apparent that this wasn't something he necessarily enjoyed or wanted to exploit or anything like that. I mean, he turned down a lot of the interviews that would be familiar after an event like that, right? You would see these people maybe on the TV morning shows and all sorts of different situations. And he wore it very subtly. So, and part of it was just his own background and upbringing, and that's why I called him a complicated hero. He had struggles in his own life with drug addiction and, you know, being in and out of prison. And yet, when I talked to people in the wake of his death, there were all these people whose lives he had changed in profound ways, other people who, you know, maybe also struggled with their own addictions. He had friends he helped get back on their feet. And so as he kind of made his way through life, he was always... I felt this really great empathy he had for others as he kind of struggled with himself, too.
Mm-hmm. And did I understand correctly, you spoke with his mother for this piece?
Yeah, and so think about that. Think about a mother, who watches her son go through and have these problems in life, but also is suddenly raised to this hero status. And that does not solve anything. And so Jason's mom had a real emotional roller coaster the last several years of her son's life, saying that he had, chance after chance to sort of, kind of make a turnaround, and it didn't really happen for him in the end. And yet, in the wake of his death, she was really heartened by all these people coming forward, talking about the change that he had affected in their lives.
Mm-hmm. So he died in his 50s in 2017. Was it linked with his addiction, his struggles there?
By all accounts, his death was, he didn't have a fixed address when he died. He was kind of going from place to place and, still in the throes of something. But, a few months after his death, actually on the anniversary of that photo and the rescue, his mother held a brief ceremony on a pedestrian bridge over the river to kind of mark to kind of mark her son's act and memorialize him one last time there. Mm-hmm. So that happened just this past summer.
Well, Kyle Munson, thank you for joining us to help remember, you say a complicated hero. I think that's a great way to put it. Jason Oglesby died in April of 2017. The man at the center of that heroic act captured in a photo, capturing the nation's and the world's attention back in 2009. When he rescued a woman from the churning waters of the Des Moines River after she and her husband plunged over the Center Street Dam. Kyle, thanks a lot for helping us remember.
Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This past year, we said goodbye to a number of remarkable Iowans. This hour, we're talking with people who knew them and can tell us a little bit about their lives and what made them remarkable. Archie Willard of Eagle Grove died in February of this year. He's an Eagle Grove man who didn't learn to read until he was 54 years old because of dyslexia. But he went on to found, he was an international advocate for adults with learning disabilities and founder of what is called Value USA. Joining us now, Marty Finsterbusch is executive director of Value USA. And hi, Marty.
How you doing?
We're sorry for the passing of Archie. We want to find out about how this organization started, but before, make us acquainted with Value USA. What is it?
Well, Value USA is a very unique organization. What it is, people who learn to read or write as adults or learn English as adults got together nationally and created Value USA to bring the adult learner's voice into the national arena. Because programs are being created for people and everything else, but the people that are most effective don't have a voice. And so that is what Value is. We are the alumni of adult basic education in the United States.
Mm-hmm. So this started in the late 1990s.
Correct. And so Archie helped bring the first group of adult learners together to create Value USA.
Mm-hmm. So what can you tell us about Archie's life before he learned to read? Most of his life, he couldn't read, and it was undiagnosed dyslexia, right?
Yes. So in adult ed, or in the United States, there's a lot of people with learning disabilities that were undiagnosed way back when. And so now they're adults living their lives and just say, well, I'm not a good reader. Or they get married and someone else manages their bills, or they do, and they go on and they survive, except then later in life, say they lose their spouse or they lose their job, they need help. And so in Archie's case, he got to 54, and now he's now working on his reading and writing. And he brought up his reading level and realized his learning disabilities. And just not only learning how to read, he didn't just stop. He kept on going to help the next person. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes Archie unique. He's always thinking about the next person and how to help the next person who has learning disabilities.
Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, if you grow up and you're not able to read, you say, I'm not a very good reader. But as you say, you seek out people with help. But there's a tremendous stigma attached to that, isn't there? And so Archie's work, your work, has gone a ways to destigmatize that?
Yes. So just because we lack a skill in reading and writing doesn't mean we're less than a human being. And a lot of people take it, a self-image of themselves is really low. Like I myself have a severe learning disability, it's dyslexic. And so you build up an image that you're less than other people. And one of the things Value does and Archie does, he got other people to realize that you have other skills and you have other things that has value and you can have the next person. And so that's what Value does. It gets people see that they have value and that they can make a difference. It's really mind-shifting. It's also getting the system to look at people with learning disabilities different. Like, yes, we have a problem, but there's amazing things we can do. So work with us on our strong points so we can overcome our weaker points.
Mm-hmm. As you said, Value USA is the only national organization run by adult learners. What were the biggest challenges when it was founded by Archie Willard? You've been its only executive director, I believe, in the late 1990s.
Yeah.
What were the keys and the big hurdles to do that?
In the 80s, adult learners just started to get involved in adult ed. Before, you would just come into a program, they help you or they don't help you, and you're gone. And then in the 80s, adult learners start to get more involved and say, hey, why can't we be on staff? Why can't we get back? Why can't we help? And so more adult learners start to get involved. And but one thing we couldn't do is, how do we meet? How do we talk to each other? How do we support each other?
Mm-hmm.
And so at the time, there was the National Institute for Literacy out of the federal government, and Archie got a fellowship there. One of the first adult learners ever get a fellowship with the national government. And so then after that, they gave seed money to actually bring adult learners together. So Archie helped coordinate and get 45 adult learner leaders from around the United States in one place called Highlander up in the mountains of Tennessee. You should check out that history of Highlander. And so you had 45 adult learners come together to create value. So our biggest issue is, how do we talk to each other? How do we communicate with each other? And that was the biggest hurdle at the beginning of all this. And Archie took the lead to help straighten out some of that issues.
Mm-hmm. Marty, tell us a little bit about the organization now. How widespread? What is its reach? How many people has it helped, or does it help?
Value is national. What Value biggest thing has done now is that we are a resource center for all of adult ed, for student involvement and leadership. So when other national organizations want to get adult learners involved, or they have issues dealing with adult learners, we're it. We're the only organization in the United States specifically looking at adult education through the eyes of the adult learners. And so we now have many years of experience in helping that. The other thing we have done, we have developed a leadership training program where we actually take staff and adult learners, and we bring them together and teach the critical thinking skills, organizing skills, the diversity training skills that actually improve a program. So if value goes into a local program, that program will get improved. And we have research on our website to prove that we can improve almost any adult ed program now. And so value is just a resource for our field to help the next person. And that's what value's main thrust is.
Marty, before we say goodbye, tell us a little bit on a personal level about Archie Willard, his personal qualities that stood out.
What makes Archie unique is determined. He was determined to make life better for the next person, so it didn't happen to him. So you have to say he almost had a stubborn point on him when he thought an issue had to be fought, where he had to stand his ground to make sure his voice was heard. And that's what made unique. Instead of saying, well, I got what I needed and walk away, he stood and fought for the next person to make life better for them. And that's what makes him so unique.
Marty, thank you for helping us remember the life of Archie Willard, who died at the age of 86 from Eagle Grove, died in February of 2017. A man who didn't learn to read until he was 54 because of dyslexia, but then made learning disabilities, adult literacy, a major cause of his life. Marty Finsterbusch, Executive Director of Value USA, thank you so much for helping us remember Archie.
Thank you.
I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour on River to River, we're celebrating some notable Iowans who passed this year. Former Lieutenant Governor Joy Corning died in May of 2017 at the age of 84. Corning served two terms as Lieutenant Governor beginning in 1990. My colleague Emily Woodbury spoke with former Lieutenant Governor Sally Peterson about Corning.
Well, I think Lieutenant Governor Corning is probably, her greatest legacy was her strong commitment to justice and equality for everyone, really. And those values infused everything she did. So one of the things I think she was best known for was the diversity conference that she created. It was a statewide conference to promote inclusion and equality for women, children, people with disabilities, and gay and lesbians. And I think that, this was something that she cared deeply about, and she really, continued that work after she left office. She agreed to serve as the honorary chair of One Iowa, and if you'll remember that, a nonprofit organization that was working on behalf of marriage equality at the time. She also has had a scholarship named for her, the Matthew Shepard Scholarship, which is given annually to an LGBT student in Iowa. So these were things that were important to her and of interest to her. She was very much about promoting inclusion and equality and respect for one another.
And I noticed that former Lieutenant Governor Corning, she wrote her own obituary, and she didn't include her political career in her obituary. What do you think that says about her?
Well, I think that Joy knew that her legacy would speak for itself. She didn't need to list her accomplishments. I'll share an example. After she left office in 1998, she became aware of the need for a chapel at the Women's Correctional Facility in Mitchellville. So she led a successful campaign to raise the money to build the chapel. And this was sort of a quiet thing under the radar. It wasn't easy. It was a real challenge to raise that money. But she took it on. And, I think that just sort of speaks to the kind of person that she was. She wasn't looking for, she wasn't promoting herself, and she wasn't looking for praise. She just wanted to accomplish things for others.
And you, as a Democrat, you worked with Corning, a Republican, together during the 2010 judicial retention elections. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, Lieutenant Governor Corning and I were co-chairs of Justice Not Politics, and that was a bipartisan effort to support fair and impartial courts. We wanted to keep politics out of our courts and keep our judicial system fair and impartial. So we chaired these efforts in 2010. Unfortunately, we were not successful in that retention vote, but we were successful in 2012, and I think it was because we were able to get more voters to understand the importance of protecting our court system from attacks that were intended to politicize them.
And how did you come together to work on this? Because I have to say, nowadays it seems a little unique that a Republican and a Democrat would work together on anything. It seems a little bit out of the norm nowadays. How did you come together?
I think Joy was always interested in the common good and always interested and willing to work across party lines. We've known each other, and I think because we had such a, well, we attend the same church, and we have known each other for years. And even though I was a Democrat when she ran for nomination in the primary, I was supportive of her as a Republican moderate. And we had a personal relationship that transcended politics, but I think that she had a lot of personal relationships that transcended politics. That was something special about Joy. So we had worked together for the Interfaith Alliance. We had worked together and shared values on supporting Planned Parenthood. And so it was kind of a natural that when issues arose that were that needed bipartisan voice, we were willing to be sort of the visible representation of that.
So I noticed, Sally, when you spoke with the Des Moines Register, you mentioned that Joy refused to let labels define her. And I thought it was interesting that among the four organizations she listed for memorial donations to remember her by was Planned Parenthood of the Heartland. What does that say about Joy Corning?
Well, she's been a longtime supporter of Planned Parenthood. And, at one time there were, many Republican moderates who were supportive of Planned Parenthood. And I think, that has really changed over the years. So I think at one time she, was not the rare Republican. Unfortunately, it's very difficult for a Republican to be elected holding a pro-choice view today. But certainly I think there are many Republicans who do support Planned Parenthood. They just can't get elected to public office. So, I think it was really appreciated that she was a spokesperson and a visible representation of Republicans who do support Planned Parenthood.
Former Lieutenant Governor Joy Corning, she died before she could see Kim Reynolds take the office of governor this week. What do you think that would have meant to her?
Well, it, as you know, Lieutenant Governor Corning was very active in the organization's 50-50 by 2020, and that, too, is a bipartisan statewide effort to elect more women to public office. So, though I'm sure she'd be pleased to see that there's progress on this front, she wouldn't be satisfied until they reach their goal. And, you know, that means that by 2020, the goal is to have 50% of all office holders be women. So, you know, I think she's always happy to see us make progress, but joy's never satisfied until you reach the goal.
IPR's Emily Woodbury in conversation with former Lieutenant Governor Sally Peterson, remembering Iowa legislator Joy Corning. She died this past May at the age of 84. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available by going to iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music is written and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your comments and your questions about this program. You can contact us anytime, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.